Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zafalo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzafalo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. Rob Frankenberry, you are a vocalist, pianist, composer. You are very well known in the Pittsburgh music community. And this is why I would like to talk to you today about the cattle industry.
Ah, absolutely. I have many opinions that are entirely hot air, and in fact, enough to sear your filet to perfect well done.
Very good.
Actually, not well done, perfect rare. I'm a rare guy.
Should I invest is what I want to know.
Right? Absolutely.
Yeah, now's a good time?
Any time's a good time to invest in
beef, cattle.
In cattle.
I will stop at the Burger King on my way home. But before that, let's talk about you. And, you know, what
I
you
am
do.
A tenor. I'm not sure that you want to ask me to do that because we might never stop.
Did you want it? Oh, you'll just keep going and going. Is that a trait of a tenor? Tenors are known to be talkative?
Yes. Well, at least they're known to be windbags.
Okay, so talkative was a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
We're already good cop, bad cop, we've established.
Well, talking implies that the words mean something.
Ooh.
And, you know, I...
You all are catty with each other.
Yeah. Oh, you know it. Absolutely. Phew. You know, I was just in Milwaukee for 8 weeks, and close to the hotel where I was kept, and I say kept, meaning they would open the gate and let me out for rehearsals and then, you know, corral me back in. But
that's the union rule, right?
Yes, exactly. There was actually a high school very close called Tenor High School. Which, of course, I mean, now the secret's out.
They're segregated.
You always thought there was a special training academy, and there is, because those skills are not natural.
I know you took pictures of it.
I did.
You did?
Yes, they're on my Facebook page.
All right, good. We can reference
yes,
them.
Yes, you can find them.
There, fantastic. I have always been envious of, well, musicians, but especially those that are multifaceted. It just, you know, every musician like that just strikes me as a savant. You know, now if you think back to your earliest musical experiences, was it something that came naturally to you, or did you really have to work at it?
Yes.
Which?
Both.
Okay.
Both. I mean, you know, it was one of those things. I mean, you know, it's a cliche, but it does sort of have to be more natural than breathing if you're going to make a life out of it. And there are many different ways of having music in your life, and even for many professional level musicians, it's actually a constant struggle to make your living at music, but to really have music in your life, because you can get so caught up with the practicing and the practicing. Actually, what once was a pleasure might become a chore because you're so worried about being able to produce the product. And there's a lot of pressure, and of course the schedule is always too tight. No, for me, I know that there was a time, I didn't start studying the piano until I was about 12, even though I had started asking for lessons apparently before I was three.
Oh.
And I did take myself through the sort of the first piano books, but I know there was a time that I couldn't read music, I just can't remember it. And I do look back at things and wonder how I ever was able to do things. It's like, because now I look at a thing and I think, this is hard, I have to practice this, and I played it when I was 15, and I think, how did I ever get through that?
So even for a musician as seasoned as you are, practice is still a big part of
the weekly discipline.
Well, yes, and it's very easy, especially for somebody who a lot of my playing for many years was accompanying in either in a voice studio or, you know, if you're playing 8 hours of opera rehearsal a day, you're playing a reduction and your job is to sort of try and recreate some of the texture of the orchestra. And so it's very easy for your technique to sort of just get thrown by the wayside. And before long, you know, you try to play a scale out of context and you can't really do it, because there's something of a luxury in the rituals of going back to just the basic issues of the instrument and sort of having a chance to step back from producing a thing and look into just the act of how you're producing the sound or whatever. In singing, I often say it's one thing to be in vocal shape when you're singing a lot, because often during production week you come off, you know, you have very little time off, and so you're singing all the time and your voice is very warm. But then I often find myself in the middle of that week thinking, man, I really need to just vocalize for a day or something, because you feel it start to get wonky and out of shape.
Well, vocal recitals are a large part of what you do. And you know, I didn't tell you this, but I saw you perform.
Oh dear.
A vocal recital.
It's
gosh,
a lie.
This had to be, around maybe 7-8 years ago.
Oh goodness.
No, it was in a
completely different voice type then.
It was in a church, and I want to say that you were wearing a cape, although I might be subconsciously combining you with Adam Sandler's Opera Man character from Saturday Night Live. But
if I wasn't, I should have been. No, well. Did you see the a few years ago over at the Carnegie Music Hall?
No, so you lost me at a few years ago.
Okay.
I'm not even sure if I'm remembering
I
you in a cape
Aristide
correctly.
I played Aristide Bruant with a cape and a red scarf and a big black
okay.
hat.
Okay. Oh,
with
I
Ben
don't
Binder
know.
and the Pittsburgh Song Collaborative.
Can you count on one hand all the times that you've worn a cape, or it's got to be more than that?
Well, yes, actually. I mean,
and I'm talking about on stage.
On stage. I haven't worn that many capes. I have when I played Don Ottavio. I once did a play version of Phantom of the Opera, where I had to play Enrico the house tenor, you know, and so I had to wear big capes and, you know.
But I'm positive it was you.
Okay.
Because you have a very memorable name.
It is, yes. I make no money off of the cereal, unfortunately.
Do folks bring that up a lot, or am I the only tacky
jerk
that's done?
Oh, no, nobody has ever, you know, nobody's ever noticed that before. Actually, my brother was in the Navy for 20 years, and he was on submarines for several of them. And his submates used Boo for his nickname, because
Booberry.
And Boo is much easier to say than Frankenberry.
Well,
all of the Italians, all of the real Italians that I know, call me Frank. Because what kind of name is Frankenberry? They probably just assume Frank and Barry. Hey, Frank, how you doing?
Now, I know that when I walked in here, you probably pegged me as a Count Chocula kind of guy. But I have got to tell you, Booberry, all the way.
Yep.
And
yep, I was always a Booberry guy, too.
The flavor, and the character, too. I love that character. Do you remember the ghost with that
absolutely.
Sort of rumpled hat and those heavy eyelids? He kind of looked like a old-time bourbon drunk.
Yeah, you know? Exactly, which I think I was naturally drawn to that.
There was a connection there.
It's an image of myself in the future.
Right. You were looking into a time warp. That's me. So breakfast cereal. It's come back now.
Well, yes, you know, the thing is that in different market areas, they have different names of the same product. There's something called Yummy Mummy in part of the
Now, he was not part of the original trio. That's...
No. Now, see, we were moving from St. Louis, Missouri to just outside Minneapolis, St. Paul, just as the Frankenberry cereal was coming on the market and General Mills was producing it in Minneapolis.
And somewhere, I guarantee you, there's a Rob Yummy Mummy that's gone through the same struggle that you have.
Absolutely, yeah.
But the name has much recognition here in this region beyond breakfast cereals, of course. With all that you do, I mean, is it a challenge to sort of carve a career path when, you know, you're conducting, you're doing vocal concerts, you're playing the piano? Which way do you go?
Well, yes. it is challenging and difficult. The most challenging thing for me, though, is on the very personal level, each of these sort of aspects of what I do has a different body position and sort of a different kind of base personality. I know it sounds a little, it's probably medicatable, but you know.
Oh.
But you know, when I'm playing a lot of opera rehearsals, because you're sitting there for so long, it's very easy. That guy sort of, you know, slouches.
And you become the phantom.
And you can get very angry and very bitter if you're not careful. Conductors, with a conductor, it depends on if you're conducting mostly vocalists or if you're conducting orchestras, because as an orchestra member, I can tell you that once you put a herd of musicians into a pit, there we become a sort of one creature, and we have to be wrangled in a different way than wrangling singers usually involves a lot of ebullience and telling them how wonderful they are and looking them directly in the eyes. And you know, wrangling an orchestra means not talking too much, and you know, you have to know what to say when, and then you have to know exactly what moment to sort of pull out the inner jag off.
Well, you know, that's interesting to know, because I think for the job and the technique of a conductor, I think to the untrained eye, it might appear that somebody's just up there, you know, waving their arms, you know, very easily imitated. And by the way, I have seen some of the great imitators, Bugs Bunny, Mr. Bean.
One cannot.
But let's talk about the technique of a conductor. And what makes a good one?
Well, probably what makes a successful conductor these days, at least, is actually the most important thing is your rehearsal technique.
Mm.
Because when you get into the performance, I mean, especially if you're fortunate enough to be conducting any group anywhere near the stratosphere that the Pittsburgh Symphony is in, for example, especially if it's on repertoire that's familiar, you know, it's easy to make the orchestra feel like they're there to make you look good. And okay. whereas a big part of my job when I'm conducting, if I'm conducting concert music as opposed to an opera, is really helping the orchestra look good. And what that really means is the best thing you can do is give useful feedback. And then if there's time to do more than that, that's great. Of course, absolute clarity with the stick or the hands, if you don't use sticks, is paramount. But I think that it actually has mostly to do with preparation. When you get up on the podium, you have to be able to have absolute certainty and authority in your knowledge of the piece when you give that downbeat. And if you don't have it, the orchestra can see you coming.
They can smell fear.
Yeah, so then there's an awful lot of not looking at the conductor that starts to happen.
Oh.
But I don't know. You know, every orchestra has a personality and every conductor has a personality. And somebody who might be a brilliant conductor for one group might be a disaster with another one. And then, of course, there's the whole thing of, I don't consider myself a symphonic conductor. I thought that I wanted to be, of course, in undergraduate school, because who doesn't want to be the guy waving their arms during Mahler 8 or something? You know, that's exciting. But it turns out that I know how to hold a show together. I can hold a show together from behind the piano. You know, I mean, we did a show a couple of years ago in the Allegheny Cemetery, and I was sitting on a rock with a keyboard and a string quintet, and the soprano was on the lake, and we had two clarinets on either side of the lake, and somehow it held together because it's a show, and I know how to do that.
Yeah.
So part of my, you know, being an opera conductor is partly about being able to live with subjugating your desire, with your concept of the perfect performance, and being able to go with the performance that's happening in the moment, because what we do is, you know, always a hair's breadth away from
death.
Total disaster. Which is, you know, the only thing better than great opera is really, really, really disastrous opera.
Well, they usually do end in tragedy. I mean,
and sometimes the story's sad, too.
Oh, very good.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, Joe. Very ribald, indeed. But now, in all of this that you do, do you find time to relax? What is relaxing for you?
I feel like I'm relaxing all the time.
Great.
Actually, I think part of the reason that I do too many things is because I feel convinced that I'm just lazy, And so I do all of these things because if I always have to have something finished, then I don't have time to be lazy. So it's a smoke screen.
You know, I kind of understand what you're talking about.
Yes, I think many modern people do. I think it's the 21st century.
That's why I put on this tuxedo and pour martinis. Mm-hmm. Because somebody could think I was just...
Well, honestly, I mean, seriously, it's like, how often do we really get to go out and just have that conversation over you know, tea, many martinis, and just talk about things.
Life is short. Yes. What have you yet to check off your bucket list?
Oh, heavens, I haven't sung Peter Grimes yet. That's the thing. that might be the only reason that I'm really still insisting that I have to sing. I'd probably like to sing Forza, La Forza del Destino, the Verdi. I have not been to the continent of Europe. I've been to the United Kingdom several times. I've performed in actually all three. In the UK, in Scotland and Ireland. I need to go back to Ireland and stay with it just to hang out sort of down on the coast.
It's calling to you.
Yeah. Have you been?
No.
Oh.
I think I would like it. I like lush green places.
You have no concept of what lush green looks like until you get off the plane.
Yeah.
It's pretty unbelievable. It really is magic.
I'll put that on my list.
So... What? No, I I like to say I live a very jazzy life. You know, I mean, exactly, pretty much. Even when it seems like, I'm not doing anything right and nothing's working out, I actually then look back at what I've had the opportunity to do in life. I think I have one good comic opera in me, one good full-length comic opera that I will probably write someday, but I need to find the right libretto. And I had found the perfect one some years ago. There's an old film, is it Gina Lola Brigida, called Buonasera, Mrs. Campbell? And I watched it and I thought, oh, this is perfect because I can use Mozart da Ponte style stuff for the Italian, and do like Italian scenes, and then the Americans that come over, the former World War II guys come back to have a reunion in this Italian town, and it turns out that Gina Lola Brigida has had a daughter by one of them, but nobody knows which one.
And, you've got to do this.
Well, the problem is that no sooner had I planned it out and said, this is going to be perfect, that I realized that was actually the source material for Mamma Mia.
Oh,
although operatic rights are separate from film rights, and because I have a friend who has rights to several Bret Easton Ellis novels that have been made into musicals or films, but those rights are separate. So,
but still, somebody might look at that and say he got that from Mamma Mia.
Although apparently, I've not seen Mamma Mia. Sorry, it's not because I don't want to. It's because every time I go to New York, I'm rehearsing, so I don't have time to go see Broadway shows. But I have heard from a number of people that perhaps nobody would actually recognize the plot. So, you know,
I think it's been done a couple times.
I'm pretty sure. Well, you know, there are 8 stories, 14 stories. There's, you know, Romeo and Juliet, and
there's 18 and stories.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
That's all that's
well,
out
you know,
there.
I mean, that's there is actually a. I don't remember who the author is now. That's how I'm showing my ignorance. But there was a significant writer in the 20th century who sort of codified these things, and it's long been held that there really are only a few base stories.
Well, then you've got to come up with something so wacky and so bizarre that it breaks the mold.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe your own story.
Oh, goodness.
What?
I don't know. That might be...
Is that one of the 18?
I think I could hire Stephen King to write that one.
Would it be more It? Would it be more Misery? Well, we'll stay tuned.
It would be miserable It. I don't know. It's miserable.
We've just written it.
Yeah, done. Done.
My agent will be calling
you. Oh, very good.
But you have premiered plenty of works by many, many living composers. I think well over 150, is that it?
I wrote that down once. It depends on the size of them, I suppose, because, you know, every year I probably play 20 or 30, like, 5 to 15-minute pieces. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to bigger pieces, like, you know, a duo for violin and piano an opera or something. You can count that in different ways, but a big part of my life is in new music that has not been done before.
And we do have to specify that these are premieres by the by living composers.
Yes.
Yeah, the deceased ones really aren't premiering much anymore.
Every once in a while, you do find something that was, you know, wrapped around a fish that hasn't been performed before. But
now, do you feel that composers are appreciated more after their death than during their lifetime?
Well, I mean, appreciated is a complicated word. In the aesthetic sense, yes. In the personal sense, maybe. I mean,
depends. Right?
I mean, the more you know about Beethoven, the less you appreciate him as a person. He seems like he would have been a pretty awful friend. But poor man. But certainly, as a composer, yes. I mean, I think we have a very different view of what works and what doesn't now than in his time. I mean, certainly, that, you know, string quartets love to argue about the Große Fuge, you know, that late string quartet. And some people still feel that it's just insanity, but most people feel that it's the thing they want to spend a year, you know, working with their quartet mates on. So
I sometimes think it's unfortunate that they get more due after they're gone.
Well, you know, it takes a while for players to figure out how to do things. So, you know, there's this theory called the 100th monkey theory, which is that if you have an island and you have two groups of monkeys of the same species, and there's like a reef or something right down the middle, the impenetrable crag that they can't get to each other, if one monkey on one side of the island learns a new way to clean a mollusk, let's say, by the time he's taught 99 other monkeys on that side of the island to clean the mollusk that way, all of the monkeys on the other side of the island know how to do it too. So if you think about it in terms of music, if you think in terms of the Rite of Spring, which for its premiere, which by all accounts was disastrous, and not just because there was a riot, I think that they really still couldn't hold it together in Paris. They had over 40 rehearsals before the premiere, and they still couldn't play it. And now a youth orchestra can do it in 4, and it sounds sort of more opulent than Scheherazade, because we know all the tricks. All the monkeys have figured out how to play the hard licks and how it goes. So part of it is that new music always tends to sound rough and edgy and sort of uncertain in certain spots. And that's one of the things, I think, that draws some people to it, and other people perhaps don't enjoy it so much.
I'm still on the monkeys and the mollusk.
Well, I mean, have you had grilled mollusk? It's good.
Yes, it is. And
but you got to take the spines off first.
Right, and so somebody had to learn from somewhere. Now I get your point. But I want you to know that while you are here and living, that you do not have to die in order to gain my appreciation.
Why, thank you. I'll drink to that.
And you know what, Rob? That's probably the nicest thing I've ever said to anybody.
Good for you.
Or not. But now, what do we have coming up this summer? You are you do have a position with Opera Theater Summerfest.
Yes, yeah? I am the music director for the company, which means that I sort of try to be the point person to make sure that orchestra questions are answered, and that parts are properly marked and, you know, given out, and sometimes there's reorchestration to do, or when we're planning a piece, actually, a lot of times it's the question of how many pieces do we need in the orchestra, can we make it work with this many? One year I made a version of Carmen for flamenco guitar, accordion, fiddle, you know, double bass.
I bet you that was great,
because
it's
a
lot of that sort of gypsy feel
yeah,
to
we
it.
We did it in a black box.
That makes sense.
So, you know, I sort of just try to help keep those things on track and step in where things need to be done. And that also involves me getting to do a certain amount of conducting. And this year I will be conducting the premiere, asked about new works, of a piece called A New Kind of Fallout by my dear friends Tammy Ryan, who was just a guest
yeah,
of yours.
Yeah, we just chatted with her.
Gilda Lyons, who got her master's degree at the University of Pittsburgh, and that's when I first met her quite a few years ago. And when we decided we wanted to do something sort of inspired by the life and works of Rachel Carson, Tammy Ryan immediately came to mind, and Gilda Lyons came to mind. So we put them together, and we have something really spectacular and exciting. And it's definitely, you know, one of those lifetime achievements to be involved in the first time out on a piece like this.
Yeah.
So.
So with no basis of comparison, I mean, when you're doing the classics, I mean, there's hundreds of years, you know, behind that reputation. So how is it? How is your approach different to something that's never been done before?
Well, there's a certain freedom in that you don't have any preconceived ideas about Tempe or things, you know. And so in a way, it's a blank slate. You know, you're the people who are going to decide how it's done. Because once it's been done and an archival recording has been made, the next people that do it are actually going to base what they do on your recording, no matter how poor it is. So I have composer friends who tell me that it's, you know, it's like, well, everybody plays this particular bar this way because they think that's how it's supposed to go.
And that's easier than just reading the music, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, well, it's funny. The ear is a very complicated thing, and the human mind is even more complicated. So, you know, it's all about neural pathways.
That's another interview.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. But basically, you crack the spine as soon as you can, which is never soon enough, and you just the spine of the book, not.
I was hoping.
Yeah.
I didn't think you were that. Malicious in your. Direction.
No, I'm the nice guy. I'm the one who says it's okay. You try to get a sense of where the drama's going. You play through the bits at the piano and get a sense of what's the musical language like, and you put a lot of things together and hope something sticks. And you know, sometimes after you finish the piece, you realize, maybe this should go this way. But there are things that you don't know about a piece until the audience energy speaks back to it.
That's true.
I have often rehearsed pieces and felt that certain sections were going to be the real knockout punch. And then in the performance, you sort of feel kind of a lukewarm energy from the audience in another spot that you sort of thought was, this is not so great, is the thing that just puts everybody over the edge. So I think there's a lot to be, you have to be open to just following the direction that the piece takes you, which of course is what we all say we're trying to do when we're doing Mozart or Verdi and things, but you do have a certain level of awareness that the audience already knows how some of it goes. So
that kind of goes with the territory, mm-hmm. doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, what's next for you then after A New Kind of Fallout?
The next thing I get to go up to Vermont, to Montpelier, for about 10 days.
Oh, boo-hoo.
I know, poor me. I get to do a sort of guest presenter seminar on vocal writing for composers in the graduate program at the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and then come back and go straight into rehearsals for The Winter's Tale with Quantum Theater and Chatham Baroque and Tack Theater. And that's very exciting. I will be playing Polixenes, which is easy to say sometimes. that guy. yes. So I get to sing some of Shakespeare's great lines, and I'm very excited about that. And then immediately, actually, that will overlap with the beginning of the school year at the University of Pittsburgh.
That's right, you're teaching.
Yes,
too, on top
I have. I'm very excited. I decided that, you know, 40, it was not too soon to settle down and have an office and a full-time job. So I will be joining the faculty of the University of Pittsburgh Theater Arts Department.
Bravo.
As a lecturer in musical theater.
Excellent.
And we're diving straight into 9. Well, actually, not till the spring term, but we're going to do 9 with a 30-piece orchestra and, you know, small things.
You are keeping busy, my friend.
Well,
I think you've really found your niche. Do you feel that?
I do, actually, yes. And I feel like I wouldn't... I like being at this point in life, and I'm looking forward to the thing, because I'm just kind of getting good at things. So,
just now?
Yeah, just now. I've seen the past
It's
three
been
or
a sham,
years.
Everything before.
Well, pretty much. I feel like probably in the past year or so, like, okay, now I can actually call myself a singer, and, you know, I'm starting to play well. So, life is good, but I wouldn't go back to being 25 for anything.
Here's to being old and decrepit.
Oh, you got it. And not having to wear 80 seconds.
Cheers.
In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Bergvavant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Bergvavant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvavant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.